This is an objective claim about the human mind, about the dynamics of social relations, and about the moral order of our world. It is clearly possible to say that someone like Hitler was wrong in moral terms without reference to scripture. While feeling love for others is surely one of the greatest sources of our own happiness, it entails a very deep concern for the happiness and suffering of those we love. Our own search for happiness, therefore, provides a rationale for self-sacrifice and self-denial. There is no question that there are times when making enormous sacrifices for the good of others is essential for one's own deeper well-being. Nothing has to be believed on insufficient evidence for people to form bonds of this sort. At various points in the Gospels, Jesus clearly tells us that love can transform human life. We need not believe that he was born of a virgin or will be returning to earth as a superhero to take these teachings to heart. One of the most pernicious effects of religion is that it tends to divorce morality from the reality of human and animal suffering. Religion allows people to imagine that their concerns are moral when they are not, that is, when they have nothing to do with suffering or its alleviation. Indeed, religion allows people to imagine that their concerns are moral when they are highly immoral, that is, when pressing these concerns inflicts unnecessary and appalling suffering on innocent human beings. This explains why Christians like yourself expend more moral energy opposing abortion than fighting genocide. It explains why you are more concerned about human embryos than about the life-saving promise of stem cell research. And it explains why you can preach against condom use in sub-Saharan Africa while millions die from AIDS there each year. You believe that your religious concerns about sex and all their tiresome immensity have something to do with morality. And yet, your efforts to constrain sexual behavior of consenting adults, and even to discourage your own sons and daughters from having premarital sex, are almost never geared toward the relief of human suffering. In fact, relieving suffering seems to rank rather low on your list of priorities. Your principal concern appears to be that the creator of the universe will take offense at something people do while naked. This prudery of yours contributes daily to the surplus of human misery. Consider, for instance, the human papillomavirus. HPV is now the most common sexually transmitted disease in the United States. The virus infects over half the American population and causes nearly 5,000 women to die each year from cervical cancer. The Centers for Disease Control, or CDC, estimates that more than 200,000 die worldwide. We now have a vaccine for HPV that appears to be both safe and effective. The vaccine produced 100% immunity in the 6,000 women who received it as part of a clinical trial. And yet, Christian conservatives in our government have resisted a vaccination program on the grounds that HPV is a valuable impediment to premarital sex. These pious men and women want to preserve cervical cancer as an incentive toward abstinence, even if it sacrifices the lives of thousands of women each year. There is nothing wrong with encouraging teens to abstain from having sex, but we know, beyond any doubt, that teaching abstinence alone is not a good way to curb teen pregnancy or the spread of sexually transmitted disease. In fact, kids who are taught abstinence alone are less likely to use contraceptives when they do have sex, as many of them inevitably will. One study found that teen virginity pledges postponed intercourse for 18 months on average, while in the meantime, these virgin teens were more likely than their peers to engage in oral and anal sex. American teenagers engage in about as much sex as teenagers in the rest of the developed world, but American girls are 4 to 5 times more likely to become pregnant, to have a baby, or to get an abortion. Young Americans are also far more likely to be infected by HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. The rate of gonorrhea among American teens is 70 times higher than it is among their peers in the Netherlands and France. The fact that 30% of our sex education programs teach abstinence only, at a cost of more than $200 million a year, surely has something to do with this. The problem is that Christians like yourself are not principally concerned about teen pregnancy and the spread of disease, That is, you are not worried about the suffering caused by sex. You are worried about sex. As if this fact needed further corroboration, Reginald Finger, an evangelical member of CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, recently announced that he would consider opposing an HIV vaccine, thereby condemning millions of men and women to die unnecessarily from AIDS each year, because such a vaccine would encourage premarital sex by making it less risky. This is one of many points on which your religious beliefs become genuinely lethal. Your qualms about embryonic stem cell research are similarly obscene. Here are the facts. Stem cell research is one of the most promising developments in the last century of medicine. It could offer therapeutic breakthroughs for every disease or injury process that human beings suffer, for the simple reason that embryonic stem cells can become any tissue in the human body. This research may also be essential for our understanding of cancer, along with a wide variety of developmental disorders. Given these facts, it is almost impossible to exaggerate the promise of stem cell research. It is true, of course, that research on embryonic stem cells entails the destruction of 3-day-old human embryos. This is what worries you. Let us look at the details. A 3-day-old human embryo is a collection of 150 cells called a blastocyst. There are, for the sake of comparison, more than 100,000 cells in the brain of a fly. The human embryos that are destroyed in stem cell research do not have brains or even neurons. Consequently, there is no reason to believe that they can suffer their destruction in any way at all. It is worth remembering in this context that when a person's brain has died, we currently deem it acceptable to harvest his organs, provided he has donated them for this purpose, and bury him in the ground. If it is acceptable to treat a person whose brain has died as something less than a human being, it should be acceptable to treat a blastocyst as such. If you are concerned about suffering in this universe, killing a fly should present you with greater moral difficulties than killing a human blastocyst. Perhaps you think that the crucial difference between a fly and a human blastocyst is to be found in the latter's potential to become a fully developed human being. But almost every cell in your body is a potential human being, given our recent advances in genetic engineering. Every time you scratch your nose, you have committed a holocaust of potential human beings. This is a fact. The argument from a cell's potential gets you absolutely nowhere. But let us assume for the moment that every 3-day-old human embryo has a soul worthy of our moral concern. Embryos at this stage occasionally split, becoming separate people, identical twins. Is this a case of one soul splitting into two? Two embryos sometimes fuse into a single individual called a chimera. You or someone you know may have developed in this way. No doubt theologians are struggling even now to determine what becomes of the extra human soul in such a case. Isn't it time we admitted that this arithmetic of souls does not make any sense? The naive idea of souls in a petri dish is intellectually indefensible. It is also morally indefensible, given that it now stands in the way of some of the most promising research in the history of medicine. Your beliefs about the human soul are, at this very moment, prolonging the scarcely endurable misery of tens of millions of human beings. You believe that life starts at the moment of conception. You believe that there are souls in each of these blastocysts, and that the interests of one soul, the soul of a little girl with burns over 75% of her body, say, cannot trump the interests of another soul, even if that soul happens to live inside a petri dish. Given the accommodations we have made to faith-based irrationality in our public discourse, it is often suggested, even by advocates of stem cell research, that your position on this matter has some degree of moral legitimacy. It does not. Your resistance to embryonic stem cell research is, at best, uninformed. There is, in fact, no moral reason for our federal government's unwillingness to fund this work. We should throw immense resources into stem cell research, and we should do so immediately. Because of what Christians like yourself believe about souls, we are not doing this. In fact, several states have made such work illegal. If one experiments on a blastocyst in South Dakota, for instance, one risks spending years in prison. The moral truth here is obvious. Anyone who feels that the interests of a blastocyst just might supersede the interests of a child with a spinal cord injury has had his moral sense blinded by religious metaphysics. The link between religion and morality, so regularly proclaimed and so seldom demonstrated, is fully belied here, as it is wherever religious dogma supersedes moral reasoning and genuine compassion. Doing good for God. What about all of the good things people have done in the name of God? It is undeniable that many people of faith make heroic sacrifices to relieve the suffering of other human beings. But is it necessary to believe anything on insufficient evidence in order to behave this way? If compassion were really dependent upon religious dogmatism, how could we explain the work of secular doctors in the most war-ravaged regions of the developing world? Many doctors are moved simply to alleviate human suffering, without any thought of God. While there is no doubt that Christian missionaries are also moved by a desire to alleviate suffering, they come to the task encumbered by a dangerous and divisive mythology. Missionaries in the developing world waste a lot of time and money, not to mention the goodwill of non-Christians, proselytizing to the needy. They spread inaccurate information about contraception and sexually transmitted disease, and they withhold accurate information. While missionaries do many noble things at great risk to themselves, their dogmatism still spreads ignorance and death. By contrast, volunteers for secular organizations like Doctors Without Borders do not waste any time telling people about the virgin birth of Jesus, nor do they tell people in sub-Saharan Africa, where nearly 4 million people die from AIDS every year, that condom use is sinful. Christian missionaries have been known to preach the sinfulness of condom use in villages where no other information about condoms is available. This kind of piety is genocidal. If you can believe it, the Vatican is currently opposed to condom use even to prevent the spread of HIV from one married partner to another. The Pope is rumored to be reconsidering this policy. Cardinal Javier Lozano Barragan, president of the Pontifical Council for Healthcare, announced on Vatican Radio that his office is now conducting a very profound scientific, technical, and moral study of this issue. Needless to say, if church doctrine changes as a result of these pious deliberations, it will be a sign not that faith is wise, but that one of its dogmas has grown untenable. We might also wonder, in passing, which is more moral? Helping people purely out of concern for their suffering, or helping them because you think the creator of the universe will reward you for it? Mother Teresa is a perfect example of the way in which a good person, moved to help others, can have her moral intuitions deranged by religious faith. Christopher Hitchens put it with characteristic bluntness. Mother Teresa was not a friend of the poor. She was a friend of poverty. She said that suffering was a gift from God. She spent her life opposing the only known cure for poverty, which is the empowerment of women, and the emancipation of them from a livestock version of compulsory reproduction. While I am in substantial agreement with Hitchens on this point, there is no denying that Mother Teresa was a great force for compassion. Clearly, she was moved by the suffering of her fellow human beings, and she did much to awaken others to the reality of that suffering. The problem, however, was that her compassion was channeled within the rather steep walls of her religious dogmatism. In her Nobel Prize acceptance speech, she said, "The greatest destroyer of peace is abortion. Many people are very, very concerned with the children in India, with the children in Africa, where quite a number die, maybe of malnutrition, of hunger, and so on. But millions are dying deliberately by the will of the mother. And this is what is the greatest destroyer of peace today. Because if a mother can kill her own child, what is left for me to kill you and you kill me? There is nothing between." As a diagnosis of the world's problems, these remarks are astonishingly misguided. As a statement of morality, they are no better. Mother Teresa's compassion was very badly calibrated if the killing of first trimester fetuses disturbed her more than all the other suffering she witnessed on this earth. While abortion is an ugly reality, and we should all hope for breakthroughs in contraception that reduce the need for it. One can reasonably wonder whether most aborted fetuses suffer their destruction on any level. One cannot reasonably wonder this about the millions of men, women, and children who must endure the torments of war, famine, political torture, or mental illness. At this very moment, millions of sentient people are suffering unimaginable physical and mental afflictions, in circumstances where the compassion of God is nowhere to be seen, and the compassion of human beings is often hobbled by preposterous ideas about sin and salvation. If you are worried about human suffering, abortion should rank very low on your list of concerns. While abortion remains a ludicrously divisive issue in the United States, the moral position of the Church on this matter is now fully and horribly incarnated in the country of El Salvador. In El Salvador, abortion is now illegal under all circumstances. There are no exceptions for rape or incest. The moment a woman shows up at a hospital with a perforated uterus indicating that she has had a back alley abortion, she is shackled to her hospital bed and her body is treated as a crime scene. Forensic doctors soon arrive to examine her womb and cervix. There are women now serving prison sentences 30 years long for terminating their pregnancies. Imagine this in a country that also stigmatizes the use of contraception as a sin against God. And yet this is precisely the sort of policy one would adopt if one agreed with Mother Teresa's assessment of world suffering. Indeed, the Archbishop of San Salvador actively campaigned for it. His efforts were assisted by Pope John Paul II, who declared on a visit to Mexico City in 1999 that the Church must proclaim the gospel of life and speak out with prophetic force against the culture of death. May the continent of hope also be the continent of life. Of course, the Church's position on abortion takes no more notice of the details of biology than it does of the reality of human suffering. It has been estimated that 50% of all human conceptions end in spontaneous abortion, usually without a woman even realizing that she was pregnant. In fact, 20% of all recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage. There is an obvious truth here that cries out for acknowledgement. If God exists, He is the most prolific abortionist of all. Are atheists evil? If you are right to believe that religious faith offers the only real basis for morality, then atheists should be less moral than believers. In fact, they should be utterly immoral. Are they? Do members of atheist organizations in the United States commit more than their fair share of violent crimes? Do the members of the National Academy of Sciences, 93% of whom reject the idea of God, lie and cheat and steal with abandon? We can be reasonably confident that these groups are at least as well behaved as the general population. And yet, atheists are the most reviled minority in the United States. Polls indicate that being an atheist is a perfect impediment to running for high office in our country, while being black, a Muslim, or homosexual is not. Recently, crowds of thousands gathered throughout the Muslim world, burning European embassies, issuing threats, taking hostages, even killing people, in protest over 12 cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad that were first published in a Danish newspaper. When was the last atheist riot? Is there a newspaper anywhere on this earth that would hesitate to print cartoons about atheism for fear that its editors would be kidnapped or killed in reprisal? Christians like yourself invariably declare that monsters like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, and Kim Il-sung spring from the womb of atheism. While it is true that such men are sometimes enemies of organized religion, they are never especially rational. And Hitler's atheism seems to have been seriously exaggerated. In a speech on April 12, 1922, Hitler said, "My feeling as a Christian points me to my Lord and Savior as a fighter. It points me to the man who once in loneliness, surrounded by a few followers, recognized these Jews for what they were and summoned men to fight against them, and who, God's truth, was greatest not as a sufferer, but as a fighter. In boundless love as a Christian and as a man, I read through the passage which tells us how the Lord at last rose in his might and seized the scourge to drive out of the temple the brood of vipers and adders. How terrific was his fight for the world against the Jewish poison. As a Christian, I have also a duty to my own people. In fact, the public pronouncements of these men are often delusional. On subjects as diverse as race, economics, national identity, the march of history, and the moral dangers of intellectualism. The problem with such tyrants is not that they reject the dogma of religion, but that they embrace other life-destroying myths. Most become the center of a quasi-religious personality cult, requiring the continual use of propaganda for its maintenance. There is a difference between propaganda and the honest dissemination of information that we, generally, expect from a liberal democracy. Tyrants who orchestrate genocides or who happily preside over the starvation of their own people also tend to be profoundly idiosyncratic men, not champions of reason. Kim Il-sung, for instance, demanded that his beds at his various dwellings be situated precisely 500 meters above sea level. His duvets had to be filled with the softest down imaginable. What is the softest down imaginable? It apparently comes from the chin of a sparrow. 700,000 sparrows were required to fill a single duvet. Given the profundity of his esoteric concerns, we might wonder how reasonable a man Kim Il-sung actually was. Consider the Holocaust. The anti-Semitism that built the Nazi death camps was a direct inheritance from medieval Christianity. For centuries, Christian Europeans had viewed the Jews as the worst species of heretics and attributed every societal ill to their continued presence among the faithful. While the hatred of Jews in Germany expressed itself in a predominantly secular way, its roots were religious, and the explicitly religious demonization of the Jews in Europe continued throughout the period. The Vatican itself perpetuated the blood libel in its newspapers as late as 1914. The blood libel, with respect to the Jews, consists of the false claim that Jews murder non-Jews in order to obtain their blood for use in religious rituals. This allegation is still widely believed throughout the Muslim world. And both Catholic and Protestant churches have a shameful record of complicity with the Nazi genocide. Auschwitz, the Soviet gulags, and the killing fields of Cambodia are not examples of what happens to people when they become too reasonable. To the contrary, these horrors testify to the dangers of political and racial dogmatism. It is time that Christians like yourself stop pretending that a rational rejection of your faith entails the blind embrace of atheism as a dogma. One need not accept anything on insufficient evidence to find the virgin birth of Jesus to be a preposterous idea. The problem with religion, as with Nazism, Stalinism, or any other totalitarian mythology, is the problem of dogma itself. I know of no society in human history that ever suffered because its people became too desirous of evidence in support of their core beliefs. While you believe that bringing an end to religion is an impossible goal, it is important to realize that much of the developed world has nearly accomplished it. Norway, Iceland, Australia, Canada, Sweden, Switzerland, Belgium, Japan, the Netherlands, Denmark, and the United Kingdom are among the least religious societies on Earth. According to the United Nations Human Development Report, 2005, they are also the healthiest, as indicated by life expectancy, adult literacy, per capita income, educational attainment, gender equality, homicide rate, and infant mortality. Insofar as there is a crime problem in Western Europe, it is largely the product of immigration. 70% of the inmates in France's jails, for instance, are Muslim. The Muslims of Western Europe are generally not atheists. Conversely, the 50 nations now ranked lowest in terms of the United Nations Human Development Index are unwaveringly religious. Other analyses paint the same picture. The United States is unique among wealthy democracies in its level of religious adherence. It is also uniquely beleaguered by high rates of homicide, abortion, teen pregnancy, sexually transmitted disease, and infant mortality. The same comparison holds true within the United States itself. Southern and Midwestern states, characterized by the highest levels of religious literalism, are especially plagued by the above indicators of societal dysfunction, while the comparatively secular states of the Northeast conform to European norms. While political party affiliation in the United States is not a perfect indicator of religiosity, it is no secret that the red states are primarily red because of the overwhelming political influence of conservative Christians. If there were a strong correlation between Christian conservatism and societal health, we might expect to see some sign of it in red state America. We don't. Of the 25 cities with the lowest rates of violent crime, 62% are in blue states and 38% are in red states. Of the 25 most dangerous cities, 76% are in red states, 24% in blue states. In fact, 3 of the 5 most dangerous cities in the United States are in the pious state of Texas. The 12 states with the highest rates of burglary are red. 24 of the 29 states with the highest rates of theft are red. Of the 22 states with the highest rates of murder, 17 are red. Of course, correlational data of this sort do not resolve questions of causality. Belief in God may lead to societal dysfunction. Societal dysfunction may foster a belief in God. Each factor may enable the other, or both may spring from some deeper source of mischief. Leaving aside the issue of cause and effect, however, these statistics prove that atheism is compatible with the basic aspirations of a civil society. They also prove, conclusively, that widespread belief in God does not ensure a society's health. Countries with high levels of atheism are also the most charitable, both in terms of the percentage of their wealth they devote to social welfare programs and the percentage they give in aid to the developing world. The dubious link between Christian literalism and Christian values is belied by other indices of social equality. Consider the ratio of salaries paid to top-tier CEOs and those paid to the same firm's average employees. In Britain, it is 24 to 1. In France, 15 to 1. In Sweden, 13 to 1. In the United States, where 80% of the population expects to be called before God on Judgment Day, it is 475 to 1. Many a camel, it would seem, expects to pass easily through the eye of a needle. Who puts the good in the good book? Even if a belief in God had a reliable, positive effect on human behavior, this would not offer a reason to believe in God. One can believe in God only if one thinks that God actually exists. Even if atheism led straight to moral chaos, this would not suggest that the doctrine of Christianity is true. Islam might be true in that case, or all religions might function like placebos. As descriptions of the universe, they could be utterly false, but nevertheless useful. The evidence suggests, however, that they are both false and dangerous. In talking about the good consequences that your beliefs have on human morality, you are following the example of religious liberals and religious moderates. Rather than say that they believe in God because certain biblical prophecies have come true, or because the miracles recounted in the Gospels are convincing, liberals and moderates tend to talk in terms of the good consequences of believing as they do. Such believers often say that they believe in God because this gives their lives meaning. When a tsunami killed a few hundred thousand people on the day after Christmas 2004, many conservative Christians viewed the cataclysm as evidence of God's wrath. God was apparently sending another coded message about the evils of abortion, idolatry, and homosexuality. While I consider this interpretation of events to be utterly repellent, it at least has the virtue of being reasonable, given a certain set of assumptions. Liberals and moderates, on the other hand, refuse to draw any conclusions whatsoever about God from his works. God remains an absolute mystery, a mere source of consolation that is compatible with the most desolating evil. In the wake of the Asian tsunami, liberals and moderates admonished one another to look for God not in the power that moved the wave, but in the human response to the wave. I think we can probably agree that it is human benevolence on display, not God's, whenever the bloated bodies of the dead are dragged from the sea. On a day when over 100,000 children were simultaneously torn from their mother's arms and casually drowned, liberal theology must stand revealed for what it is, the sheerest of mortal pretenses. The theology of wrath has far more intellectual merit. If God exists and takes an interest in the affairs of human beings, his will is not inscrutable. The only thing inscrutable here is that so many otherwise rational men and women can deny the unmitigated horror of these events and think this the height of moral wisdom. Along with most Christians, you believe that mortals like ourselves cannot reject the morality of the Bible. We cannot say, for instance, that God was wrong to drown most of humanity in the flood of Genesis, because this is merely the way it seems from our limited point of view. And yet you feel that you are in a position to judge that Jesus is the Son of God, that the Golden Rule is the height of moral wisdom, and that the Bible is not itself brimming with lies. You are using your own moral intuitions to authenticate the wisdom of the Bible. And then, in the next moment, you assert that we human beings cannot possibly rely upon our own intuitions to rightly guide us in the world. Rather, we must depend upon the prescriptions of the Bible. You are using your own moral intuitions to decide that the Bible is the appropriate guarantor of your moral intuitions. Your own intuitions are still primary, and your reasoning is circular. We decide what is good in the good book. We read the Golden Rule and judge it to be a brilliant distillation of many of our ethical impulses. And then we come across another of God's teachings on morality. If a man discovers on his wedding night that his bride is not a virgin, he must stone her to death on her father's doorstep. Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 through 21. If we are civilized, we will reject this as the vilest lunacy imaginable. Doing so requires that we exercise our own moral intuitions. The belief that the Bible is the Word of God is of no help to us whatsoever. The choice before us is simple. We can either have a 21st century conversation about morality and human well-being, a conversation in which we avail ourselves of all the scientific insights and philosophical arguments that have accumulated in the last 2,000 years of human discourse, or we can confine ourselves to a first century conversation as it is preserved in the Bible. Why would anyone want to take the latter approach?